This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, everyone. And this is Tamel Pittman. We both come from the same community, which is basically one of those marginalized communities. And as Creston said, I had spent 11 years in prison, in East Jersey State Prison. And in that prison was where, the funny thing about it is that I always have a lot to say about education and what type of education you get in these communities, which I think is directly linked to a democracy. Because if you don't have a quality education, there's really no way to participate in a democracy. In fact, when you listen to some of these political debates, you actually won't understand what's actually being said. So it's easy to get duped, and it's easy to dupe the public. Because I think that it's sort of flattening out even amongst economic classes. You know, at one time, the poor communities were sure to get a pretty crappy education. However, now it's becoming the middle class America is starting to get a pretty crappy education. And this makes it easy for some of this political theater to happen, because a lot of people don't actually know what's going on. So in any event, I just want to say briefly is that I started my education in what is known as Piscataway, New Jersey, and this is the middle class area. And it was a great education, you know, just considering the quality of education now, it was a pretty good education. And by the second grade, my family fell on hard times. Well, let's say we were back to hard times. And what initially happened is we were moved back to New Brunswick to a more urban, poor environment. And I experienced a decline in my education, and which came to be almost no education at all. It was a lot of rote behavior and memory and multiple choice things that were going on. Now, I just say that to say is that now I went through school having a pretty crappy education and didn't get much of an education until I went to prison. And when I went to prison, there was a New Jersey STEP program that was brought into the prison in which they were giving individuals an opportunity to go to college and receive an associate's degree. And this is where I met Chris Hedges. He actually came in to teach a class. And in teaching that class, what he wanted to do was he wanted to create a play. We had maybe 28 students. And out of 28 students, he wanted to create a play speaking about our experiences. And what we did, each of us took the subjects and we went back to ourselves, our different spaces, and we all began to write. And then we would hand in all this material the next day in class. And Chris would take it home, he would read it, and he would figure out which was quality work, what we could use and what we couldn't use. And no names were put on it, so it was, you know, it was a fair process. And the amazing thing in that is that he took all these different writings and he sort of sewed them together like a blanket. And what came out of that was one play that reads like one voice of 28 different people who are situated throughout New Jersey in different poor communities who have the same exact story. I mean, if you read the play, you would think there was literally one author. And with this play, what we're doing, we're humanizing a family. So the play centers on one family. You know, we talk about some of the social ills that take place in some of these communities and why, you know, you see a rampant crime in some communities. And it shouldn't be strange to most people because actually, you know, crime is a byproduct of poverty. You know, it's just what happens. You know what I mean? If there are limited resources or no resources, people will resort to different measures. And their morality breaks down. And when that happens, the whole community breaks down. And when you still have poverty and it's not addressed, you just continue to socially reproduce some of the same things. And you know what? In any event, what I wound up doing after we got the play, that's just like my story about how me and Chris Hedges are connected. But the thing is that getting a quality education in prison and out, once I got out, I got accepted into Rutgers University, where I'm now pursuing a degree. My BA in psychology and a minor in sociology. But the thing is that now I understand things a lot differently. You see things a lot differently, and they change the choices that you actually make. And I mean, you understand things about yourself, things about your community. So I'm definitely, you know, one who echoes that education is the key, you know, to a lot of things. Because what you get is, you get a different level of behavior while we're competing against some of these global forces and political forces. Because people understand what's going on and you respond differently. So you resist differently. You know, what you might see now in some of the black communities is rage and a resistance that is, you know, misdirected in some instances. But when people understand which ways to resist, which will give you the best results, you choose that way. You know, and what you get is, you get a different sense of history. And history teaches us a lesson. And when Chris gives a history lesson, he shows you what worked in other places, you understand that doing more of what doesn't work doesn't work. So let's use these methods, opposed to some of the methods that you would see individuals who haven't had the privilege of a great education. They're using whatever methods they have at their disposal. Or the emotion is just running its course. You know, so education is definitely one of the main things that helped transform my life and something. Absolutely, absolutely. And this is one reason why I brought Tamel with me. It's Tamel Pittman, and I'm going to allow him to speak.
Thank you. Me and Boris grew up on the same street corners. He's a few years older than me, but we suffered the same circumstances. You know, the difference between me and him, well, it's kind of a gift and a curse type of thing. You know, incarceration was his blessing because he's getting a college degree out of it. Me not going to prison was kind of like I don't even have my high school diploma. So everything that I've learned was self-taught and self-educated. You know, me being an advocate, me being an activist, and things of that nature. But, you know, the last time we interact, it's amazing to interact on this level. The last time we interact, we'll probably be cleaning guns. I don't want to get you in trouble. Is it statute of limitations? Or, you know, but that, you know, before him going to prison and, you know, before me taking a turn, you know, we were, you know, in a negative atmosphere. And, you know, like I said, my turn was just pure luck. I didn't get incarcerated because I was lucky. You know, I didn't do anything better than he did. You know, I probably made a right on this corner when he made a left, and we just ended up, you know, in different circumstances. But I've learned, you know, I was hearing stories about him while he was incarcerated. He was an inspiration and he didn't even know it. You know, he was learning and he was educating himself in incarceration, and I'm starting to read more books and I'm starting to, you know, advocate in the community. And once you become an advocate in your community, you actually become you actually get blackballed for some reason, you know, because you're changing around people who are not trying to change. And so it was kind of difficult for me to become an advocate, to, you know, fight against police brutality, to advocate, you know, go to school board meetings, go to council meetings, go to freeholder meetings. You know, this was kind of unorthodox for a person of my background, but I think I stay consistent. You know, and I stayed persistent, and I definitely saw change, because you don't experience change, you don't change unless you're amongst the, like, if I come to people now, average person, 10 years ago, they'd just be getting out of bed on a Sunday. But I'm here in Princeton with you guys. So when I come back to my atmosphere, it's like, it's a culture change. It's a culture shock. So, you know, definitely, you know, education is important. Because, you know, me going to school, so we went to the same schools, Redshaw School, and we had, you know, inadequate education that I learned now was inadequate as an adult. You know, I had teachers who would tell me all the time, you know, you make a great attorney, but never pushed me in that direction of becoming an attorney. Snaz, I'm married with three kids. I have a 16-year-old, and I live in a great school. I mean, you know, the school system is excellent where I'm at, and there's no excuse for failure with my children. And we were allowed to fail as a grade school student. I was allowed to fail. I'm quite sure the same situation with him and family members. So as an adult, I know that, you know, failure was an option. You know, my school had every right to educate me like my children are being educated, and we failed to have that opportunity. So that's not just, I'm not just a rare occasion. There's a lot of people my age who face the same circumstances. And, you know, like you said, education is important. You know, I'm a example that you can change on the streets. You can become an advocate, humanitarian. I never thought, you know, being 40, coming from Remsen Avenue, that I, you know, receive an award from the NAACP. That would be the chairman of POP organization. And, you know, so you definitely can change. And I'm just, you know, blessed to have the opportunity to speak to you guys.
Thank you, everybody, for, you know, allowing me to speak and give me a moment of your time. Like Tormel said, you never really know what you're getting into with Boris, but I just, you know, learned to trust him as a friend over the brief period of time that we've known each other. So when Boris calls, he says, you know, are you available such and such a day? And you think to yourself, I might be. Depends on what it is. But again, it's a pleasure to be here and to speak to you today about, you know, some of, I guess, the most important thing in the world for all of us right now, and that is resistance. You know, I've come through the same line as Boris. I too have been to prison in New Jersey, and I had the opportunity, like Boris, to get into Rutgers University through a program that was trying to correct some of the social ills that created the pathway for people like us to go to prison. During my time there, you know, I did pretty well. In my junior year, I was like nominated for a really prestigious scholarship called the Harry S. Truman Scholarship. And I was awarded it in 2012. I was the Truman Scholar for New Jersey. Thank you. And then I went on to graduate and actually got my master's degree at the University of Cambridge in criminology. Thank you. But I said all that to say, you know, I agree and disagree with the sentiment, depending on the framing and the perspective, that incarceration was a gift, because I do a lot of work, and my work is generally focused on education in prisons and fighting against mass incarceration. And what I my biggest point of contention with the work is that it's always framed as, you know, benevolent and philanthropic. And I think that it's an injustice and it's disingenuous to the people that are directly affected by mass incarceration, because statistically, these people never really had a first chance. You know, it's always framed as a second chance and providing opportunities to people who messed up their first one, when, you know, there's not a real critical analysis of the environment and the systems that funnel people into a modern day slave camp. Which is why, you know, I'm really, you know, moved by Chris's remarks about neoliberalism and corporate elitism, because there right now is a bipartisan movement for criminal justice reform in this country that is simply, if you just have not even a critical but a basic analysis of race relations and history, is just another evolution of an oppressive system that, you know, is built on the back of white supremacy. And oftentimes I feel like I'm alone in the room when I say, you know, we can't continue to use this word reform. when I think back to when I was started really getting into the literature, I'm so happy that my ancestors weren't walking around trying to champion slavery reform. But a lot of times, my language, my rhetoric, my position falls on deaf ears because, hopeful Senator Margaret talked about is the compromise in politics and the compromise you have to make to get your organizations funded and to actually try to do some work. Is what's always, in my experience, it's what's always kind of taking up the space and the money to do things, the compromises that are made. And the downside to those compromises is that it still enforces the status quo, which disproportionately and negatively affects people that look like us. And I'm saying all this to say that I'm glad to be here today, and I'm glad to know that there are people that feel the same way I do, because I can often feel isolated. I'm often shamed for the way I think and the way I speak, and I don't get a lot of support, and I'm just glad to know that this exists. And I think one of the biggest things that we can do is as a solution to solving the divisiveness of resistance rhetoric is really starting to attack in a deliberate and aggressive way some of the systems that have been placed in our path to divide us. And biggest of them all is white supremacy. It's something that directly affects me, so it's biggest for me. I'm not trying to downplay anything else, but I just had quite a bit of a debate with one of you. We all have that friend from high school who's incredibly racist and always posting things on Facebook. My friend posted that he was incredibly proud to be white and that no one was going to shame him for being white because he had nothing to do with anything. And it kind of led me to make sure that the people that could see it and the people on my friends list knew that, whiteness is a human invention whose only utility is oppression and genocide. And I think that it is incumbent upon, thank you. I think that it is incumbent upon all of us to try to really do everything we can to destroy the concept of whiteness. Because if I'm correct, in my studies, there were black and white indentured servants in this country. And the concept of whiteness was created so that poor whites could get a fraction of what they were owed in order not to be slaves. And that idea, that simple idea, has spawned into what every force and every obstacle that affects communities where we come from. Its yoke is overwhelming. Chris spoke about the omnipotence of law enforcement, and to watch people who look like you be murdered, and the rush to justify why someone deserved to die, whether it be selling cigarettes or playing with what looked like a real gun or just driving, is traumatic in and of itself. And to see the subsequent events constantly play out with the same narrative over and over and over and over and over again can lead you to the hopelessness, the rage, and the rebellion that can take over the minds of people like Micah Johnson and Christopher Dorner and Gavin Long, not to in any way martyr those people, but to understand and empathize with them. I think this fight is incredibly important. I can go on and on and on, but I'll share one last thing with you. I have an 11-year-old son who, you know, lives with me full time. I'm a single parent. And this summer he spends time with his mother in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. And she lives in an apartment complex, and he was playing with his basketball and playing Pokemon Go on his phone at the same time. And he said there was a 10-year-old, he's 11, there's a 10-year-old kid who happens to be socially identified as white, who came over within earshot of him, but was talking to another white child and referred to my son as the nigger with the basketball. The kid is 10 years old. I think we oftentimes frame progress incorrectly. And I'm speaking to the choir here, but I'm collectively, as humans, we frame progress incorrectly. And I believe that that's where the fight begins, is the framing of all of these situations. And right, it's about language, it's about how we talk, and it's about how we can build movements from that language. I'm not going to get out of your way right now. Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I'm pretty sure that there are going to be some more great speakers. Thank you.